Back now with day-to-day internet for everyone. That's the general idea put forth today by a coalition of advocacy groups and the tech industry. They are calling on Congress and President-elect Barack Obama to come up with a national broadband strategy. But as Joel Rose reports in this installment of our Memo to the President series, such proposals face opposition from both the cable and telecom industries.
President-elect Barack Obama has not said who he'll appoint to lead the FCC next year or what the commission's priorities will be. But if the people advising the transition team are any indication, high-speed internet access may be near the top of the list.
This really is a utility. This is like water, electricity, sewage systems, something that all Americans need in order to succeed in the modern era.
That's University of Michigan law professor Susan Crawford, one of two people charged with advising the Obama-Biden transition team on the FCC. Crawford declined to be interviewed for this story, but she did speak at a roundtable discussion earlier this year at the Tech Policy Summit in Los Angeles. Also on that panel was a White House science advisor, Ambassador Richard Russell.
The bottom line is that the U.S. is still, I think, the most dynamic broadband economy in the world.
Susan Crawford called that, quote, magical thinking.
We're not doing it all well for reasons that mostly have to do with the fact that we failed to have a U.S. industrial policy pushing forward high-speed internet access.
That's exactly what many of the FCC's critics have been waiting to hear. Ben Scott is the policy director for the nonprofit group Free Press.
We simply don't have enough competition in our broadband markets.
Scott says Americans are paying more for less, which is why the U.S. has fallen out of the top 10 countries in the world when it comes to the percentage of households using broadband. Right now, just over half of American homes have it. That puts us behind Denmark, the Netherlands, Norway, Switzerland, Iceland, Sweden.
If you look overseas, most of the world's leading nations have half a dozen or more different companies offering a similar broadband product. They're competing on price. They're competing on speed. They're competing on the attractiveness of the services that they offer on top of their broadband package.
So in London, for instance, there are at least 9 internet providers offering a range of services starting at the equivalent of $10 a month. They can do that, says Scott, because governments abroad have worked with industry to lay wires and equipment that are used by multiple providers. Contrast that with the U.S., where phone and cable companies enjoy a duopoly in most markets. But there's plenty of competition in the U.S., according to Joe Waz. He's a spokesman for Comcast Corporation, the nation's largest cable company and its second largest internet provider.
Speeds have kept going up. Prices have stayed flat on a real dollar basis and have continued to decline in terms of the price per megabit delivered.
Waz says his competitors at the phone companies are investing billions of dollars in faster fiber optic networks. And in some places, cable companies are responding by opening up more of their channels to broadband, but not everywhere. About 10% of Americans still have no access to broadband at all. Many of those people live in rural areas. Wally Bowen runs a small internet company in Asheville, North Carolina.
Well, the cable companies don't find it cost-effective. Phone companies have to reconfigure their landlines with additional technology. And there's been some of that, but it's been pretty limited.
Bowen and others hope that new wireless technologies recently approved by the FCC will eventually solve the rural broadband problem. But even Comcast Corporation's Joe Waz says this is one issue that could benefit from government intervention.
I think the smart use of government funds, to the extent that we care to put them into broadband infrastructure, would be to bring broadband where it isn't.
Waz warns that cable and phone companies won't build new infrastructure where they don't expect to make money. Current FCC Commissioner Robert McDowell agrees. He says the FCC has already taken steps to encourage more private investment in broadband infrastructure.
I think we need to be wary of any policy that might scare away capital, especially given the state of the capital markets today. I don't think just a $100 billion taxpayer-funded program to wire up America is the right way to go right now.
But Free Press's Ben Scott isn't so sure. Scott says there is a precedent for this kind of major public-private partnership in American history.
I look at this as a real Eisenhower moment. You look back at the 1950s and the government and the private sector got together and they've triggered investment in our highway systems. We need to have a similar 21st century highway bill where we invest in our broadband infrastructure.
That information highway won't be easy to build. Scott says such a plan would require unprecedented leadership from the White House, Congress, and most of all, the FCC, because it's likely to face vigorous opposition from cable and telecom companies. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
The mayor of San Francisco, Gavin Newsom, is said to love talking about every detail of running his city. And now he's found a way to make sure that anybody in the world can hear him. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mayor Newsom is legally obliged to deliver the State of the City address in October with the arrival of the new fiscal year. But it comes late this year. The tech-savvy mayor bristled at having to limit his remarks before a live audience to 1 hour, says his press secretary, Nathan Ballard.
He's a policy wonk. You know, he wants to go to the transportation advocates and say, hey, here's what we're doing to improve Muni. And that takes almost an hour just by itself. And so a traditional State of the City format doesn't really work.
Newsom is releasing his State of the City address in 10 45-minute segments. The first two were released yesterday. Each webisode is designed as a standalone discussion on everything from the city's universal health care program to poverty and emergency planning. Here's a taste of the introduction.
The opportunity for you to spend 1 minute with me, 1 hour, as much as 5 or 6 hours if you choose, but an opportunity to do something a little bit differently by engaging you directly in the issues of the day here in our great city.
The mayor's staff knows he's opening himself up to more than a few jokes, but technology forecaster Paul Saffo calls the idea gutsy.
It's brilliant because he gets to say everything he wants to say. He gets to be the first person who tried saying it in this way. And he's done an end run around all the people who might want to edit him.
Today, stay tuned for transportation. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. And it's time now for our weekly technology segment, All Tech Considered, and I'm joined, as always, by our tech expert, Omar Gallagher. Welcome back, Omar.
Hello, Robert.
And I gather we are going dating this week.
Well, maybe not you and I in particular, but yes, these online dating sites have become very, very popular. I mean, you might have seen ads on TV from Match.com or eHarmony, but I think people are surprised by just how widespread online dating is and just how many sites there are.
Yeah, we should say that the online dating means you meet online. The date actually takes place in not in the virtual world, but in the real world, I hope.
If you're lucky, yes.
If you're lucky. Well, we're going to talk more about this in a moment, about online dating. But first, millions of people may be using the internet to find love, but many are still making the same old analog mistakes. As April Baer of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports, there is a new industry that's devoted to helping singles put their best foot forward.
Straight white female, 41, athletic with a knockout smile, sits in front of her computer checking out the prospects.
This is JDate, which is theoretically the Jewish dating site.
Shula Newman just moved from Seattle to St. Louis. When she decided to start ramping up her social life, she, like millions of others, went online.
Even though it would be, of course, nice to find a date hot and heavy, really, I'm just more interested in meeting people at this point.
Newman's turned up some intriguing possibilities on JDate. And there's one guy looking for a special lady to appreciate him as much as he appreciates himself.
Mystery charmer. Okay, see, now, the mystery is no mystery. He's not that much of a charmer. He's with this hot blonde on his arm.
Imagine this guy walking into a party, maybe with the blonde in tow, and introducing himself as he does online.
So his profile reads, passion, so important for a fulfilling life. Yeah, that's kind of a turnoff. I just want somebody who sounds like they're talking. And at the same time, you know, I also don't like it when they're listing off their criteria in their little About Me section. Are you somebody who likes to do this and skydive and take romantic walks on the beach?
If there's hope for people with crappy profiles like this guy, it can be found with consultants like Sierra Faith. She's an online dating coach in the Bay Area who helps people retool their virtual selves. She's noticed most customers want help with their profiles.
Either they're looking for a greater kind of traffic where they can meet a lot more people, or they're busy. And a lot of women and men that are very busy tend to present themselves in the romantic arena the way that they would present themselves in the business arena. And actually, energetically, it's totally backwards.
Dozens of consultants like Sierra Faith have sprung up in recent years, offering coaching services for online dating. If you don't want to spring for one of those, even the online dating sites offer some help.
Yeah, you want to get it as close to the truth as possible.
Herb Vest is a former banker from Dallas who now runs the matchmaking site True.com. Vest says a lot of people are thinking much too far ahead when they're writing profiles. Stop looking for Mr. or Ms. Right, he says, and just find that good first date.
What you're looking for here, like a fisherman, is fish. You want to attract the fish. Once they get into the boat, you can throw them back out.
In recent years, his site has started offering help with profiles and pictures. And the site's even working on a service that identifies customer preferences and changes your profile picture based on who's looking at you. For NPR News, I'm April Baer in Portland, Oregon.
And again, I'm joined by Omar Gayaga. And Omar, in April Baer's story, we heard about a new career to take up after the investment banking job of being a mortgage broker, I guess, has gone south. Online dating coach. This is actually a job?
Yeah, it is a growth industry. I tracked one down in Los Angeles named Evan Mark Katz. Now, he is an online dating expert, and he has clients who will pay him between $2,000 and $3,000 to coach them on online dating. And what that buys you is about 4 to 8 weeks of his services. He says a lot of people get really frustrated with online dating and quit. He's there to make sure you don't. Mm-hmm. And some of his advice includes in the profile avoiding cliches and adjectives, choosing the right website, first of all, creating a witty username, and having a good headline and a professional-looking photo.
And does he guarantee that you are the only client who will get that witty username, for example, or get that advice?
I imagine so, yeah. I imagine they all have to be pretty original to stand out.
That much money you could pay people to answer somebody's online dating advertisements. I want to go back to something that you said there. Why would somebody want to avoid using adjectives in a dating profile? Words like cute and fun are not cutting it.
Well, the problem is that a lot of people use the same adjectives, and they don't really mean anything when you see them so many times on a dating site. Evan Mark Katz says that you really want to show and not tell. You want to describe the ways that you're funny or athletic or kind, not just tell people that you are those things. So he advises creating a very good essay that gives specific examples.
So we've actually recreated the role of writing love letters, albeit to an unknown recipient, that you'd hire the one literate guy in the village to do for you a couple hundred years ago.
He's a bit of a Cyrano, but one of the services he offers is not only to create a profile, which he says is just really the resume of the process. You wouldn't normally get hired on just a resume. He says you really have to create a whole package. He offers to teach you to understand the opposite sex and why they act the way they do.
Yeah, well, that's worth a lot of money. There are a lot of
it's a bargain at $2,000 to $3,000.
Exactly, that's a bargain, a steal. There are a lot of general online dating sites. eHarmony is the one that I seem to see advertised no end. But there are also there are niche markets here that I want you to tell us about.
Right, I mean it's very widespread. I mean the rise of these niche dating sites. Really, any interest you have, there's probably a dating site catering to you or groups of people like you. I mean, there's a vegetarian dating website. There's one exclusively for Catholics. There's one for millionaires. There's even a dating website for farmers.
We used to be lonely.
Until we met on Farmers Only.
FarmersOnly.com is the new online dating site for farmers, ranchers, and good old country folks.
You don't have to be lonely at FarmersOnly.com.
City folks just don't get it.
That can't be for real. You must have made that one up.
I would be so much richer if I could make that up.
Well, thanks again, Omar. Talk to you soon.
Thanks very much, Robert.
It's Omar Gayaga, who covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. And before we go, All Tech Considered needs your help for a segment that we're working on. It's about using technology to keep in touch long distance. Whether you're checking in with your spouse, traveling on business, or with your grandchildren on the other side of the country, we want to hear how you use technology to stay connected. Just go to our website, npr.org/alltech.
Within an hour of the attacks on Mumbai, a journalist had found a creative way to cover the story from thousands of miles away. In that hour, he started a call-in show on internet radio. Other Indian journalists relayed what they knew. The journalist is Sri Srinivasan. He was in New York City, where he works at Columbia University's School of Journalism, and his experience may tell us something about how media are evolving. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here, despite the circumstances.
Yes. How'd you do it in 1 hour?
Well, it's not me. It's two things. It's the community of journalists and friends that want to share information, and technology allowing us to do things we could never have done even a year ago.
And did you feel that you were getting up-to-the-minute information in this improvised radio network that was basically just available on the web?
Yes, because people who were live on the spot in India were able to call in and provide information. So we were using technology called blogtalkradio.com, and people can go to sajaforum.org to see what we're doing. But in effect, what this was is, I like to call it NPR light, or very, very light in my case.
I suppose that's flattering.
Yes, because it's, or I've also called it a poor man's NPR. But in effect, what we're doing is anyone can have a radio station and can have a radio show, and people can call in and share information and be and take questions and participate. And there's even a switchboard. You know, you have engineers who who help produce the show. And producers, we do this all just on the screen off of this platform.
Now, you used an acronym there. You said SAJA. I should say that's the South Asian Journalists Association, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And this is an organization based at Columbia, and we are a network of about 1,000 South Asian journalists across the U.S. and Canada.
And I know that you also had a Twitter site that was using that technology to get very short messages passed back and forth between many people, which raises another question for me. When you think about a situation like this where millions of people probably are text messaging and passing information back and forth, and you want to be part of that, you want to channel it and use that information, are you concerned about the quality of the information that you get?
Very, very concerned. You have to be so careful in this kind of situation. And so what you have to do is take the information and then kind of curate it so that you're sharing on your site only the best and most accurate as of that moment. That doesn't mean that things won't get through that may be incorrect, but you're seeing that also on mainstream big television, big networks also, that some mistakes will come through.
Apparently, the Indian authorities shut down the cable networks in part of Mumbai because they felt like the mainstream TV people were spreading incorrect information.
Well, that wouldn't be surprising because there's just so much confusion. And in India at the moment, there are so many people using cell phones. It's hard for us in America to imagine how cell phones are used because we do text message here, but nowhere near the level that they do in other countries and places like India. That's the main method of communication.
It's the heart of life. They've gone right around landlines, which many people never had.
That's correct.
Mr. Srinivasan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sri Srinivasan is Dean of Student Affairs at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. He's also with the South Asian Journalists Association, which within an hour of the crisis in Mumbai set up an internet radio talk show to share information about the attacks. Many retailers are hoping for a busy shopping weekend and an even busier Monday, which provides us with our last word in business today, Cyber Monday. Retailers came up with that concept 3 years ago. It's the day that online merchants offer big bargains. Monday is when workers are back in the office after Thanksgiving and can shop online at their desks. And according to a recent survey, 3 out of 10 workers plan to holiday shop while at work. Why use up your personal time with this stuff? The survey from the online job site CareerBuilder.com. Why is this survey coming from CareerBuilder.com? Do you build your career by shopping at work? Never mind. Anyway, the survey says that of those who plan to shop online from work, nearly a quarter expect to spend 2 hours or more. 13% predict they will spend 3 hours or more. But employees beware, because according to that same poll, half the employers surveyed said they monitor the internet use of their workers. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.